Hello, and welcome to episode 4 of the Beer Joke Podcast. I'm Matt.
And I'm Luke.
And we're here with the latest beer news, reviews, and this week even an interview with Christopher from Zaylat. And we're going to give you all the latest on what's going on in beer this week. What have you been drinking this week, Luke?
First of all, we just want to congratulate you on that excellent bit of Foley there. Hopefully that comes through the microphone, that bottle top popping off. There we go, look at that. So sorry, listeners, we haven't made a jingle yet, but I'm sure that's something we will get to.
Eventually.
Last night I had the oatmeal stout from Grind Up.
Oh, down in Wanaka.
Yep. So it was, did you go and see Ollie when you were down there earlier in the year?
I tried to go and see Ollie, but the day that I went there, he had been just helicoptered out after having an unfortunate genital accident.
Shit.
Yeah, it sounded pretty extreme.
While climbing?
I'm not sure exactly what happened. It was rather sensitive, so I didn't want to dig into it, but he had just been helicoptered out to a hospital in Dunedin, so I didn't get a chance to chat.
Fuck. We'll have to take a deep dive into that when we get him on the show for an interview. Well, when I popped down to Wanaka a few weeks after you, I did get a chance to catch up with him. And yeah, it was really nice to visit him at the brewery. They just set up the tap room, so you can go there and have a beer these days. And I think he's doing some really good beers. So back to the stout last night. Just what you want in an oatmeal stout. No bells and whistles, adjuncts, just beautiful, interesting malts to it. Nice bit of that sort of cacao, coffee sort of notes, and went down great on a wet winter's evening.
Oh, nice. So, yeah, I had a good stout this week as well, from Lakeman down in Taupo.
Mm.
And I think it might be the most undersold beer that I've ever seen. So it's called Blackjack Gold, and on the can it just says Blackjack Gold Stout. And then when you turn around the can, you find it's an oaked rum and raisin coconut imperial stout. And I was just like, wow, if I'd known it was that, I probably would have bought a lot more of it. But it's just the only word on the front is stout.
Well, that's one more word than we put on the beer can that we designed recently, which was just a picture of a goat. So
it was. But
how was it?
Yeah, it was nice. It was just had a little bit coming through of each of those elements. Wasn't kind of whacking you over the head with sweetness or anything. It was a bit more subtle than that. A little bit of that kind of a kind of molassesy sweetness coming through from the raisin, I think. Tied in with that rum, obviously. I didn't get a whole lot of coconut, but it was just a really nice big stout.
Beautiful.
And then counter to that, the other really nice beer that I had this week was The Fall from McLeod's, which was an American pale ale that they've made with a bunch of oats. So it's a little softer in the body than your average APA, but it doesn't carry that kind of heavy sweetness like a hazy. It's kind of heading towards a hazy IPA, but quite, almost like a mountain APA, in that kind of it's carrying a bit more softness, but still had like that beautiful kind of punchy hop character and finishes nice and clean. Just a really well-executed beer.
I haven't had any of the McLeod's beers from the last few weeks. I just saw we've got a Japanese dark lager that's arrived as well.
Yeah, Japanese dark lager and the new 802, of course.
And we had a few Hop Nation beers. So I enjoyed a glass of the Punch after Run Club on Monday.
The Mango Sour?
Yep. That was, interestingly, that went on directly after we kicked another keg, which was another Mango Sour. That was the Sliver from Boneface. Both really excellent beers, but yeah, that we've had the Punch before. We bought it under a previous import.
It was a beer of the week, the first time we bought it in Hop Nation, wasn't it?
Yeah, probably. And just, yeah, mango's such a nice flavour, and you can get a nice bit of body in there with a bit of wheat malt. And brought to mind our little mango festival that we had at the bunker that time. Do you remember that?
I do remember that. I've forgotten about that actually. It's just, was it what did we call it? Mango, I believe.
Maybe there were some more mangoes in there.
Well, we had mango from Dugas on tap.
Yep.
And we had dried mango chips on the bar. We had a mango IPA.
Mango whippy, was it?
Or? Yeah.
I think we had 5 different mango beers.
I think we did. That was a silly thing to do.
Yeah, it's strange that bar closed down, isn't it?
And yeah. Well, that night was packed. It was delicious. Yeah.
Well, maybe we didn't do enough mango beer tap takeovers.
All right, I'll make a note. More mango beer tap takeovers.
Yeah, get people into the fridge and flagon.
What else have you got to recommend this week, Luke?
Michael Jackson.
The singer or the writer?
The writer. Michael Jackson, the writer, in my interview with Christopher from Zaylat, that you're going to hear at the second part of the show. He talked about how inspired he was by Michael Jackson's books. So if you don't know, Michael Jackson is a guy who in the, I suppose, many of the 90s, he revolutionized how people think about beer. And he had multiple books. He had a TV series. TV series was called The Beer Hunter. And you can actually find a lot of those videos on YouTube.
Oh, cool.
It's brilliant just looking at some of his videos of him visiting European breweries in particular. This was at a time where all these historic beers that I love talking about and drinking so much were sort of undervalued and people didn't really think about them too much. There's a quote from Michael Jackson and he said that no one goes into a restaurant and requests a plate of food, please.
Well, it's true. So, well, for so long it was just like you get a beer and a beer is what you get. Still, in for many people it is that way. It's like you go and you order a pint of beer when it's not a monoculture.
Yeah, I remember when I think maybe the first time I went to Amsterdam in the late 90s. Yeah, even then when I started drinking beer as a teenager, I was interested in different flavours and real ales and, you know, barley wines and porters and whatever I could find. And I remember just going to a few bars in Amsterdam and it was just a beer. So you'd go into a bar and they would have one beer and it was Grolsch or it was Heineken. And it just wasn't a thing that was thought of. And as I get into my interview with Christopher a bit later, I actually reckon for centuries and centuries that people would have just drank a beer. And people didn't necessarily know that in the next town over, people were drinking Roggenbier.
Yeah, well, you wouldn't have that transmission of information and people moving around. You just, whatever your local brewery produces, and many of those classic breweries were single product breweries. They would make the beer that they make. And the region would have a number of breweries who all brew a very similar or specific style.
And often brewing in a really weird way. I think that Michael Jackson, I read another quote about him from a brewer that he said that there should be a statue of Michael put up in the town square in Brussels for everything he's done for Belgium. Because he went over to Belgium and he discovered all of these beers that the locals didn't think were special. It's just that was just what they made. And they have these oak fooders. So a fooder, if you don't know, is a massive oak barrel where the beers will be aged and they'd have all kinds of interesting bacteria and bugs in there. And there's a great story about Petrus that you guys may have drank or may have heard of. Michael Jackson just went to the brewery one day and he was chatting to the brewers about their blends and how to make their pale ale. They blended a fooder beer and some fresh pale ale. And he tried some of the sour directly from the fooder. And he thought it was fantastic. And he asked if he could buy it. And they thought he was crazy. They thought it was way too sour for anyone to actually drink this beer. And he asked if he could buy a load to take to America for some of his beer clubs that he had in America and England. And apparently the boss said, you can buy some, but only if you buy 75 hectolitres. And he said, yep, I'll do that. Just package it up for me. And to this day, Petrus is a massive seller in their individual strains as well as blended. And that's just one story about the influence that Michael Jackson had. So so my recommendation would be check out YouTube, look at the Beer Hunter TV series. And also, if you get hold of any of his books, so Christopher chats about, we spoke a little bit about social media and brewers getting influenced by Instagram, but Christopher talks about how in the late 90s he was influenced by, he had a book of Michael Jackson's and it probably was Beers of the World.
Yeah, well, there are a couple of New Zealand beers in there. I know I used to work with Ben Middlemiss, who had a couple of his beers featured in that.
So which of his beers were featured in there?
I'm not sure exactly which one it was. I think he had a couple like Benediction. It was some kind of New Zealand interpretations of Belgian styles, the kind of Abbey Ale stuff that he was doing back in the day when he was probably still at Crock and Ball or something like that. I'm not exactly sure what stage in his career he was at when he was producing those beers.
Brilliant. And yeah, so in Belgium, before Michael Jackson, the British beer writer, turned up, they'd export less than 20% of their beers. And these days it's 75-80% of the beers goes to export.
Wow.
I'm not sure if there's one person who would be a bigger influence on beer than Michael Jackson.
Yeah, and certainly it's kind of, he was really kind of at that first wave of craft beer and brewing and kind of the transition from traditional brewing to modern styles and and writing and really active at that time. So as people were discovering beer and a new wave of craft beer, being exposed to his writing and going on a journey through traditional styles down that route. So yeah, he's definitely an important and influential guy.
Maybe Louis Pasteur?
Maybe.
Isolated yeast? Well, that's, yeah, that'd be a topic of an interesting debate, I suppose, to try and think about the most influential single humans in the history of beer and beer as we see it these days.
Yeah, for sure.
Any recommendations from you this week, Matt?
Yeah, this week I've been listening again to Nathaniel Rateliff and the Night Sweats. They're an American band. They played here a couple of years ago at the Power Station, just over the road from us. And they're a kind of modern rock blues band. The lead singer, Nathaniel Rateliff, is the son of a pastor. And so he's got kind of some of those kind of gospel-y roots into their sound. But it's kind of really kind of modern energetic blues. And that gig at the Power Station that I went to might be the best gig I've ever been to. If you're into your rock, if you're into your blues, if you're into your country, it's a really kind of interesting, cool intersection of those. Unfortunately, he was featured on a KFC ad with one of his songs recently, so some people might recognise it from there, but don't hold that against him. It's a genre that I've got quite into over the last few years, is that kind of modern American blues, where it's kind of a bit more raw and authentic than some of the country, a bit more kind of rock influence than your traditional blues from back in the day. So it's kind of, it's a really nice intersection of those styles that I'd recommend. So that's Nathaniel Rateliff and the Night Sweats.
Cool. Another recommendation from me of an article, which I'll share in the show notes. Just think I came across this week about, there's a lot of archaeology happening in Wales at the moment.
Yeah, I saw you shared that in the members group. What's the deal with that? There was like some pits in the ground that had been brewed in or something like that?
There's a natural gas pipeline that's channeling through South Wales at the moment.
Yeah.
And of course, archaeologists are having to check out all of the land before it gets ripped up. They've discovered loads of habitations from Neolithic times and from the Bronze Age.
Okay.
And as part of all these communities, a key thing that they found is evidence of these hearths and troughs. And in the olden days, people would brew, well, the olden days, 7,000 years ago, people would make beer by, you'd have a big hollowed out wooden trough, and you'd heat up some big rocks in the hearth, and you'd fill your trough with some grains and water, then you'd chuck the hot rocks in, and that heats it up, gets the sugars out of the malts, and then you leave them in some earthenware pots.
So kind of like what we were talking about with Steinbier, but an even more historical addition of that.
Yeah, just very primitive, very simple.
Well, it's one of the things that I think it would be so interesting to replicate those brewing techniques, because as you mentioned, Louis Pasteur, having the opportunity to taste what those beer styles historically tasted like, and the fact that beer historically would most likely have been sour. It would be a sour beer because that you hadn't isolated those yeast strains, and you'd be having Brett and Lactobacillus and all those naturally occurring yeasts and fungi and microorganisms getting in there, producing some interesting flavors, and as well as the caramelization that you get from hot rocks. And there's some really interesting experimentation to be done there, I think.
And a lot of it probably was disgusting.
Well, it probably was, but it probably got you drunk.
Acquired taste.
Yeah.
One of these troughs that they found, so it just looks like a huge slab of wood that's completely blackened from being burnt over years. And they reckon it's from, so the earliest habitations are from the Neolithic period. So Neolithic obviously just means New Stone Age. So that's from as early as 10,000 years BC, right up to the Bronze Age, which was, that ends about 700 BC. And one of these wooden troughs was found to be continually in use for 1,500 years.
Wow.
When they did the carbon dating. And just to imagine, just the, you know, the centre of your community is where people come together and they create beer, but generation after generation.
And you would think that those communities, they'd never question that was where the beer's made, and that's where my father made the beer and his mother made the beer, and just back and back and back until it's lost, which is something that we don't really lose as much now, which is an interesting change in the way we look at history.
Yeah, and especially in our brand new country, living here in New Zealand, the newest country on earth. Obviously, us being immigrants from an older culture, being from Britain. But yeah, it is so interesting when I chat to a Kiwi and they'll mention that their Ponsonby Villa is 100 years old.
And I was like, oh yeah, that's just a house. Yeah, so it's one of the things I miss about the UK is that sense of age, in that, yeah, I've been to pubs in the UK that have been not only buildings but operating as pubs for 1500 years. Mm. And if, like, there's a little plaque, but otherwise it's just a pub.
Like, yeah, it's there for a purpose, the same as it's been for hundreds of years.
Yeah, just the casual age of things is a completely different thing.
I was also thinking a bit about the history of brewing in Norway.
Viking.
Yeah. There's the that fantastic writer, is it Lars Goshol?
Yeah, or Lars Blog.
Yep. Check out Lars Blog, another recommendation if you're taking notes at home. So this Norwegian chap just decided to do some research on all of the farmhouse breweries throughout the length of Norway. And interestingly, our good mate Mike Cheer, who's a brewing consultant that we brewed the beer Satan, Satan, Satan with him. Mike spent a considerable amount of time in Norway a couple of years ago, visiting a lot of these different regions.
He's told us some cool stories about it, how going around and how all the different farmhouses have their own house culture. And now, over the last couple of years, Kveik has become popularized as a kind of new discovery for people outside of Norway. It's a really remarkable yeast, actually. In Norway, it's kind of more like a mixed culture, where in those farmhouses, you've got these cultures that have grown up over generations. But they've been isolated now, and they ferment a lot hotter than usual yeasts and a lot faster, but still produce clean beers. So while your standard beer would normally ferment at about 18 degrees or kind of at or around your standard room temperature, Kveik yeasts ferment anywhere up to 40 degrees. And while a normal fermentation can take 1 to 2 weeks or more if it's a lager, to complete, Kveik fermentation can occur in just 1 or 2 days. Mm. I've done some experimentations with homebrew with Kveik, and it was just incredible. Like, pitched the yeast overnight and came back the next morning, and I was like, is this right? Is my hydrometer broken? I'm pretty sure this beer's already finished. And it's and they've named the beers after the yeast strains after those farmhouse brewers. There's like Voss and
Hornedal
and Opshaug, and these Norwegian farmers who now have their name on a yeast strain from that historical tradition.
Yeah, so we'll try and get Mike on the podcast to have a bit of a chat about his journeys and adventures. And but one thing that just came to mind from one of the articles in Lars' blog was about how all of this culture was so close to being lost completely, because it's inefficient to brew this way. Why would people bother? And the beer tastes weird when you could be drinking Carlsberg. And one of the things that he mentions is that they're so fortunate that in the 1850s, there was a Norwegian historian that was just traveling around the farms. And he pointed at some rocks to one side and said to the farmer, "What are those?" And he said, "Oh, they're the beer stones." And it's verbal history, oral history rather, that that's how his father made the beer. And all the way back for, I don't know if it would be 1500 years or how many thousands of years, but people have lived there for a long time. They probably made beer in similar ways.
Yeah, and that's the way these things are done. Yeah. So speaking of his tradition and historical German beer styles, I know you're extremely excited to move on to our next topic, which is Brunhilde's Fate, a Rauch beer that you brewed with Zeeland as our beer of the week.
Yes. So this is another Small Gods collaboration. We were really, really excited. Well, I keep saying we. I was really excited about brewing a Rauch beer.
I was really exasperated about you brewing a Rauch beer.
Rauch beer is simply German for smoked beer. And a Rauch beer is a lager made with malt that's been smoked. And it's as simple as that, really. And me and Matt are both drinking our glasses. I've got a lot further down my glass than you have.
You have, yeah.
Maybe I'll be finishing the bottle off.
I think you probably will. It's an ongoing point of contention between Luke and I that Luke is a huge advocate of smoked beers. Mm. And I think smoked is a great way to ruin an otherwise nice beer.
So we're going to be chatting mainly about this with, well, I'm chatting with Christopher about it in the interview later, so we won't get too into it. But one thing that's interesting to talk about is, sorry if this is becoming the beer history podcast, but it's what I'm interested in. Hopefully some of you listeners are too. Rauchbier is the beer style of Bamberg, which is in Franconia in North Bavaria. And I regret that I haven't yet visited Bamberg. I've been to Bavaria and I've spent a lot of time in Germany drinking beer, but I'm pretty desperate to get to Bamberg. It's really quite a small city of maybe, I think, 60 or 70,000 people, but they have maybe a dozen brewers there. And it's just the most incredibly photogenic, beautiful place, just amongst forests and mountains.
One of those classic Bavarian styles where you, on all the Oktoberfest postcards and that kind of beautiful scenery.
Lederhosen, dirndls, the houses all look like cuckoo clocks, real Hansel and Gretel vibe.
Yeah, I'd really love to make it to Bavaria.
And people make beer there the traditional way, and the traditional way of smoking your malted barley.
And it's using beech smoke usually, is that right?
Yep, beech would be just you kilning the barley over some wood. And of course, that's naturally going to impart some smoky flavours. Then I think we've talked about it before that in the around the 1800s in Britain, coke started being used in place of wood and in place of coal to kiln your malts. So people liked coke because it's a smokeless fuel, and that's where the pale ale came from. And you had English bitters, and that led to the invention of pilsners. And other light coloured beers.
It's like, being able to create those cleaner malts without smoke character, in my opinion, made beers a lot better.
But the brewers of Franconia disagreed strongly. They saw no reason to change the way they'd always done it. And they just survived in isolation because it's what they had a taste for. It's what their loyal customers had a taste for. They didn't see any reason to stop smoking beers.
And it's, I think, what, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's one of the few historical exceptions to the Reinheitsgebot, is that there's something about kind of regional and historical variations on beer, of which Rauchbier in places like Bamberg is one.
There are some German beer styles that predate the Reinheitsgebot. One of those that's often talked about is Gose, that you can use, well, it's made with salted water, but you can use coriander, which is in contradiction of the Reinheitsgebot.
Just to clarify, the Reinheitsgebot, for those who don't know, is the German beer purity law, where it's dictated in Germany that to be sold as beer, you have to follow very strict guidelines on what makes a beer. And at the simplest level, it is you cannot use anything but malt, hops, yeast, and water to produce it. So a lot of your blueberry milkshake, triple cream imperial stouts are right out.
Well, even using things like corn, like rice, so a lot of your macro type lagers and sort of Japanese style light bodied lagers will be out.
So is it specifically malted barley, or is there room for, because wheat presumably would be one of them. What about oats and stuff like that?
Yeah, wheat's okay, rye's okay. I'm not sure. I know that, well, I suppose rice isn't a kind of malt.
Maybe it's specific to grain. Something we could do some more research on if we're going to talk about history on a beer podcast.
Yeah, sorry, listeners. We're talking about it being a law. It very literally is a law. So if you wanted to release a grapefruit IPA in Berlin, you're not allowed to call it beer.
Yeah.
You can call it a grapefruit IPA on the label, but you're not allowed to use the word beer there.
Yeah. But back to Brunhilde's fate. This would be a really nice, like clean, slightly caramelly, biscuity lager if it wasn't for the smoke.
I can almost imagine that I'm sitting in Schlenkerle, which is one of the oldest breweries in Bamberg.
That's the classic Rauchbier brewery, right? It's the one with that kind of gothic script on the label and that kind of yellow, still sold really traditional.
Yeah, the scroll.
Yes. Yeah,
and Schlenkerle do various styles, so you can get a Helles and a Bock, but they're all made with smoke malt that is kilned in their basements. The basements go back, it's just a sort of warren of underground caverns that go back 1,000 years. Their brewery is based on an old monastery, and they've been brewing there since the, I think, 14th century. To this day, you can go and sit there in the tap room and smash a smoky Märzen in this former chapel and sit underneath the gold leaf paintings on the ceiling.
Lovely.
Pretty glamorous.
Yeah. Well, we're going to get back to more about Brynhilde's fate and Luke's interview with Christopher later. What new news is going on this week, Luke?
Oh, so embarrassingly, talking about us talking nonsense on our podcast, last week when we were talking about Gabs being postponed and we were discussing whether it happened once or twice in Auckland, Gabs has happened four times in Auckland and I've been to it every single time. So somebody just sent us a friendly message afterwards saying, oh, by the way, Gabs happened in all of these years. Bit of an omission there. But yeah, we heard from a few people saying that they'd booked accommodation and flights to travel up for Gabs, and some brewers had made special beers. So we decided to do a little event here at the Fridge and Flagon for anyone that's at a loss.
Yeah, so it's the Jerks Auckland Beer Showcase, or Jabs.
Jabs, okay.
We're still nutting out all the details, but we're going to have at least 12 taps of some top tier, unique, brand new, or cellar reserve beers from some of our favourite breweries. We're going to have an incredible food truck, Baby G Burger. So that's going to be on the 3rd of July from 12 o'clock. So anyone who's planning on being in Auckland or was planning on being in Auckland for Gabs can come along to Jabs instead and drink some delicious beer and eat some tasty burgers.
Yeah, come drink some beers with us. So we'll be releasing some announcements online about some of the beers that are going to be pouring. They're all going to be pretty special. And we've confirmed that the Urban Ort Party Gang are going to be coming along spinning discs.
You keep saying spinning discs. Is that something people say?
What? DJing?
DJing, I think, is the word you're looking for.
People talk about spinning vinyls, don't they?
Do they? I don't know. I'm not hip and with it and down with the kids. So.
Same.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about Steinbeer a bit more? We'll move on.
No, let's move on. In other news, we've been hearing a bit about all the birthdays that are happening this year. So it's really cool to see that three of the best breweries in the country, like, I'd be surprised if they're not all in the top five, are having their 10th birthday this year. That's Garage Project, Parrot Dog, and Deep Creek. So
what a coincidence.
Yeah, well, I mean,
that they all started in the same little bit of time.
In 2011, presumably.
Good year for beer.
Yeah, and so congratulations to those guys. I'm hearing rumblings about some really cool stuff coming out of all of them to celebrate. So that's going to be something to keep an eye on for the rest of the year. Anyway, our new releases this week. We've got a lot. I think we've got more new stuff going on this week than we've had for a very long time. So I'm going to motor through a bunch of it. And if you want to see more, you can jump on the website. We have our winter drop. Every season, we put out a new mixed case with beers that are reflective of the season. So this winter drop is filled with dark beers, amber ales, kind of your warming winter beers that you want to drink at this time of year. So we've got stouts, porters, brown ales, all that kind of stuff. It's a really nice selection of wintry beers at a great discount. So only $89, reduced from $102. So you can check that out. There's a bunch of 500 mils and 440s in there. So it's a really nice way to get a taste of the season. We have had a bunch of beers come up from Waitoa Brewing down in Wellington. They've just expanded their can range, so it's a chance to try them if you haven't had a go at their beers before. Three new releases from McLeod's Brewing up in Waipu, up north. Tussle for Supremacy, which is a West Coast IPA. The Great Wave, which Luke touched on earlier, which is a Japanese dark lager.
Keen.
And 802-34, which is their kind of 34th iteration of their classic New England IPA series. Got a new English beer in, Black Sheep Hazelnut Salted Caramel Imperial Stout. I had that last night and it was beautiful. Mm. Really leaning into the caramel but nothing over the top, not super cloying, not kind of your milkshake pastry end of things, just a really nice balanced but modern Imperial Stout. North End have just released a trio of Saisons, which is super interesting. One is hopped, one is brewed with herbs, and one is brewed with pears.
Really keen to try these.
Yeah, so if you like your traditional Belgian style Saisons, there's three different twists on it from North End there. An American Pale Ale in 440ml can from Heyday. Lakeman have just released a West Coast IPA Hop Rush and Blackjack Gold, which we talked about at the top of the episode. New Garage Project releases Crispy Club, which is a 330ml dry hopped lager, and Snug, which is a returning favorite, which is a milk stout in a nitro can. They've just redone the can, it looks beautiful.
It's what Guinness should be, right?
What Guinness should be. Plus the return of Arrow Street, which is one of the best beers ever produced in New Zealand and is tasting as good as it ever did.
Brilliant.
Wilderness down in Christchurch have put out Silver, which is a barrel-aged Saison. Craftwork, and I'm going to be picking up one of these for sure, have just released La Framboise. Super limited quantities. Select retailers only have about 12 bottles each, which is their raspberry sour beer, so I'm really excited about that. We have a selection from BeerFect down in Wanaka. They have released a coconut black IPA called Space Bomb. They've got a new hazy, and we've got a couple of other core range beers from them in 330ml cans. Urbanaut have just put out a double version of their Miami Brut IPA called Miami Twice.
It's a good time.
And Tropical Stout, which is the latest one in their Big Beer Small Can series. So 250ml Tropical Imperial Stout there. Talking of big beers, Boneface have just re-released the Mega Unit, which is their 10.2% hazy triple IPA. That was one of the first triple IPAs, I believe, released in New Zealand, and they've just put it out again. Deep Creek have released a new hazy in their Haiku series, which is Sentinel. It's got a cool picture of a tiger on the front. That's going to be a good time. Down from up from Queenstown in Altitude, we've got Jam Session, which is a triple fruited sour with Boysenberry, Blackberry, and Raspberry, as well as White Water, which is a hazy IPA. A bunch from Behemoth, lots of IPAs. We've got Here's Churley, their West Coast IPA Challenge winner from last year. Learn to Fly, which was their a rebrew of the first beer they brewed at their new brewery on Dominion Road, which is both those available in six packs, plus a double release of Citra beers. One is Me Time Citra, which is their single hopped hazy IPA series. And one is, now that's what I call Hoppy Citra, which is their single-hopped West Coast IPA series. Both of those are out, along with their latest brew for Heart of Darkness, which is Loose Rivet, which is another New England IPA. Finally, the other thing that we've launched this week on the website is our range of stuff that's not beer. So we have put out, we've been looking at what's available in New Zealand for non-beer drinkers. So for people listening to this podcast, it might be you on a day that you're not drinking beer. It might be your partner. It might be a friend. You might be hosting a party. So we've tried to find the best ones that we can. So we've got some part-time rangers. We've got pals coming in. We have stuff from Clean Collective, Scapegrace Gin. We've got a couple of seltzers from Garage Project, Hop Nation, and Moondog. So we're going to be looking to expand that range. Peckham Cider. So there's limited quantities of all that stuff on the website at the moment as we feel out this new area. So if there's any of those that you're particularly interested in but you can't find them, it might be because we've sold out and we're going to be re-upping on stock of those things as they come in. So that is my Fast Talk new releases section for this week.
And this week at the Fridge and Flagon, we've got a bit going on. On Friday night, there's a new Small Gods collaboration coming out.
Yeah, we've been cranking them out recently. So this one is a new version of the first ever Small Gods beer.
Which was a mum.
A Braunschweiger mum.
An historic German beer style that has not been brewed in 500 years commercially.
Well, this one hasn't been brewed in 2 years commercially.
Yeah, so this is the second mum that we're aware of.
And so the first one was Black Narcissus, which we brewed with the lads at Double Vision down in Wellington. And it was a cardamom and blessed thistle, as Luke says, a mum, which is a big, rich, heavy, dark beer boiled for 6 hours. This year we've mixed up the adjuncts that we've put in there. So this one is brewed with wormwood and thyme.
Well, the recipe is basically the same, apart from the adjuncts.
Yeah.
And we had a really good time, the Double Vision team, trying different tinctures with a whole bunch of different herbs. Wormwood is famously used in absinthe and is extremely bitter. So, as is blessed thistle that we used in the Black Narcissus.
Yeah, so that was our first infusion of that was kind of palate destroying. So we had to dial that in quite a bit.
Yes, yeah, we've used the wormwood quite delicately. There's talk that wormwood has psychotropic properties, but
I think that's mostly an urban legend from what I've heard.
Yeah, probably doesn't. Otherwise, they wouldn't let us chuck it in beer, would they?
Yeah. But yeah, we complemented that with some thyme for that kind of lovely elevated herbal note that we kind of got from the cardamom in the last brew. So we're really excited about that coming out on Friday.
And we haven't tried it yet. So yeah, keen to drink that in a couple of days when it comes out.
Well, it's actually on a pallet coming out of a van outside the window as we speak. So that's very exciting.
Right, we'd better wrap this podcast up so we can go and drink some Reflections of Narcissus.
Yeah, so we should probably tell people about the last thing that's happening in the Fridge and Flagon this week, which is we've got a DJ party on Saturday.
Yeah, Rose has organised this. I'm not sure exactly who's playing or what's happening, but it sounds fun.
Yeah, so it's I think it's Progressive House, organised by a local promoter called Federica, who knows the scene, knows great music, and that's going to be a great time. So you can find out some more information about that on the event page on Facebook, and we'll be posting about it on Instagram.
And the last thing that's happening at the Fridge and Flagon this week, it's actually next week on Monday night, we've got a special Beer Jack Run Club. Every Monday at 5:30, Beer Jack Run Club meets at the Fridge and Flagon. We run 5 kilometres and then drink a beer or two. Everyone's welcome to come and run at your own pace. And on Monday, we're doing a special event that Tom's organised, which is, well, we want some new members to come along. So come along, bring a friend.
Tom's organised some giveaways, I think, with Lululemon and Sealy. So there's yep. going to be a bunch of stuff that you can, swag that you can take home as well, probably.
And a vegan sausage sizzle.
Oh, there you go.
Cannot wait. Thanks for listening this week, everybody.
All right, and yeah, if you want to find out more about us, as we've said, the members group is there at NZ Beer Jerks on Facebook. You can find us at Beer Jerk NZ on Facebook and on Instagram, and you can find all the stuff that we've talked about on our website, beerjerk.co.nz.
Until then, cheers.
Hello, Christopher.
Hello.
Welcome to the Beer Jerk podcast. Thanks for having a chat with us.
Thank you for inviting me on.
Let's get straight into it, I suppose. I had a brilliant time brewing with you and Tom when we made Brynhilde's Fate a couple of months back. I really enjoyed chatting about your beginnings in beer and your travels and what inspired you to actually start brewing and start a brewery. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about your youth drinking beer.
So my youth drinking beer, probably pretty typical of the time. Cheap cannery draft at Lincoln University. It wasn't really such a thing as craft brewing, though. I haven't said that. It was Ducks Deluxe. It was operating in Christchurch City at that time. Mm. I don't know the light bulb moment, but yeah, the idea of brewing sounded pretty interesting. And to me, so I was in Auckland at the time, and so I guess the first port of call was to go into Galbraith's and have a chat to old Papa Smurf, old Ian there, and spent a day with him, just looking at the process. I've done a bit of reading and just putting the words to the actions. And then it just kind of grew from there. And then the OE was knocking, so went overseas and worked at a regional brewery called St Austell in Cornwall.
What year would that have been that you were living in Auckland when you first met Ian at Galbraith's?
So that would have been about 2003.
Yeah.
Probably. Yeah, so I went overseas 2004.
So. And then you managed to score a job at St Austell, which is Cornwall.
Yes. Yep, so wrote letters and emails to various loads of breweries around England. And they were the only ones that came back and said, yes, we offer a position over summer. So, yeah, I made the trek down to Cornwall and, yeah, worked there for the summer. So, yeah, that was great. That was great insight. There was about 5 of us in the brewing team.
Was St Austell a pretty traditional brewery then? Was it was all about real ales, right?
Yeah, there was no bottling. It was, yeah, just all making beer for casks, and just seemed like there were trucks just coming in and out all the time, picking up the casks and sending them out to their pubs.
How many pubs did St Austell have at the time?
I don't know. I can't remember, but there must have been a few. Must have had quite a few, just judging by the trucks going in and out. It was quite, yeah, amazing. I started off cleaning, washing the casks, and there was a lot there, and it was a never-ending job.
Well, that's quite an interesting part of the business, especially with British breweries over the centuries, that breweries would have their own houses. And that's actually where the majority of the beer was sold, to pubs that were owned by the breweries. And recently, I know that Fuller's, the brewery was sold, but the business has kept all of their houses because they have 400 pubs or something. And I suppose we're seeing that a little bit these days with breweries opening their own bars. like Good George being a key example here in New Zealand. But it seems like a pretty good business, right? If you're making beer, just start your own pub chain.
Yeah, that's right. And to a certain extent, I guess if you look at the big breweries here, Lion and DB, they don't necessarily own the pubs, but they've secured those taps so they can just move all that beer that they make. And with the smaller breweries emerging in New Zealand, it's having their own bar is seen as something pretty key to moving some volume and getting some money and keeping all that margin.
Well, so difficult now that so many taps are tied by Lion and DB, as you say. It's actually hard for breweries to get their beer into all these pubs that have got contracts with the big international guys.
Yeah, it makes it difficult, and the big guys are buying up those craft breweries so they can increase their offering, and they're more attractive to someone who's opening up a new bar. They can come along and say, look, we'll put the taps in, we've got our Steinlager, but we've also got Panhead or Emerson's. So that makes it tough.
Well, let's come back to plans for a Zeeland pub shortly, but let's go back to you cleaning those older casks and barrels at St Austell. So quite an education experience for you?
Yeah, I was there cleaning casks, and I asked to get to go into the brewery. I wanted to see more of the brewing action. So I got in cleaning the mash tun and doing jobs like that. So that was much more enjoyable for me. Just to see it was a classic old brewery with a mill at the top of the building, and then it's gravity. Yeah, gravity works its way down to the brew house, and then the wort goes down to the fermentation level. I'd love to go back now and have a look now that I know a bit more about the process. It was great experience.
Well, it's interesting just looking at all these old techniques, and of course it makes sense to have the mill on the third story and it'd be gravity fed and not have to use motors and pumps for things, and similar to the old Yorkshire stone squares. And it's pretty great to look at old technology and see what is relevant now, because a lot has been forgotten over the years.
Exactly. And that's what probably helped spark my interest in traveling around England and Europe, was the sort of the old and the new, and how they interact, and the different regions and the different parts of Europe and England, and how the culture develops, and one part of this country drinks this particular beer or eats this particular food, and then you just got to cross a river or a mountain range and it's totally different. They speak a different accent or different dialect, but they might all live in the same country. So that was quite fascinating for me, coming from New Zealand.
So where did you head to next?
Then it was just a matter of traveling around. So at the time, there wasn't a whole lot of there was a whole lot of breweries closing down, really, either getting bought out and shut down. So there wasn't a lot of opportunity in the brewing scene. So I just continued on the OE. And one of the highlights was picking grapes in the Mosel Valley with my brother, who landed a job there. So that was awesome to see Mosel Valley drink their Riesling, and we had an awesome little brewery that we could go to at the end of the day, drink some beers.
So the Mosel, that's not too far from Cologne. So the sort of beers you're drinking there, were they like Düsseldorf Alt beers or Kölsch from Cologne?
They were lagers. I remember a Heller's. And I can't remember the exact style. So, I don't remember an Alt or a Kölsch.
Well, also funny thinking about history and just these places where brewers have just got on with it for century after century. And the idea of having beer styles and different names for the beer styles wouldn't have really been a thing decades ago. It simply would be that this town on the Mosel, this is beer. And it's the only thing that they serve, and it's made in the community brew house. And people wouldn't have given it a name necessarily.
Yeah, that's what's just so fascinating that this is the beer we drink. No, don't ask questions. It tastes good. Yeah, exactly. This is how you make beer. This is the ingredients that we have available. This is what we can make. This is the water profile. Or maybe they didn't know the water profile, but this type of beer matches this water profile. These hops match these styles, this yeast. So yeah, I guess that's how it eventuated, and yeah, you would just be able to drink it. Tasted good.
So as you're traveling around Germany and Europe, you clearly were inspired, but also your brother was pretty inspired. So he ended up starting a vineyard, or was that a vineyard that was already a family business?
He was always into wine, and he got an interest working in hospitality, and then he started studying viticulture and winemaking. And he's traveled the world a little bit, different places, California, Australia, and then Europe. We've come back to New Zealand, and he's got his own wine label now, Petani Wines, and I've got the brewery, and it's on the family land, the family vineyard. So now we're working together quite closely, and we've pulled all our ideas back from overseas, and putting it all into our ideas into a garden bar, so people can come down and enjoy what we've got to offer.
Slightly unusual these days that you took your inspiration from real life experiences and going to places rather than for Instagram, which I think is where a lot of brewers get their inspiration from these days, which I'm certainly not saying one's better than the other. But when I was down brewing with you and Tom, it was quite unique, actually, just chatting to you guys about your approach to Facebook and Instagram and other social medias. And your approach being you don't do it. I'm meaning more from just a personal point of view, whereby you don't spend, well, how long in a day would you spend scrolling on Instagram and Facebook?
Well, I think when you were here, I pulled up my Instagram, then it asked for my password, and I didn't know where that password was. So there you go.
And I really enjoyed the coming down the day before we brewed together, and you were telling me all about decoction mashes, and we're making a plan. And then you got a couple of books off your bookshelf. A lot of people's approach would be, you know, doing a Google search, just checking things online. But there's, I think for so many people these days, they worry that the world might come to an end if the internet breaks.
Yeah,
you can't log on. Whereas there's a lot of information to be found that's not online.
Yeah, so maybe that shows my age a little bit as well. But collecting brewing books along the way is, it's great. You feel good. You buy a book and you read about it. You feel as though you're increasing your knowledge. And me personally, I like thumbing through a book rather than scrolling through something online on the computer. It's great just to have a book pull off the bookshelf and turn to that page that you may have inspired you or had some little bit of information that you wanted to go back to. Quite like that. So I was going to mention, we talk about talking about Instagram and getting influence from that. I got a lot of influence from, I loved looking at pictures from a Michael Jackson book.
Yes.
Where he had bears around the world, and there'd be a bottle shot and a glass, and the bear in the glass, and it'll be the particular glass that goes with the beer. And I remember when I was in St. Austell, I'd go to the local library and pull out any brewing books that I could find, and one was a Michael Jackson, and just loved looking at those pictures and wanting to go to these places and try these beers. So I guess that was kind of my Instagram fix back in 2004. But I've got that. I went and bought that book. I'm staring at it right now on my bookshelf. Just love going back to it and looking at the bottles and the labels and the glasses.
I know the book that you mean, and the Michael Jackson, his Beer Hunter TV series.
Such an
inspiration for so many people, and I do speak to so many brewers that talked about watching that series or reading his books or his newspaper articles. And I don't know if there's a romance to it or it's just an adventure. The idea that he was, I think he really brought to people's attention all this cool stuff that was happening in all these corners of the world that you'd never heard of. And I think there are so many people that probably had never heard of a lambic beer before they read Michael Jackson, or had heard of a Schwarz beer or a Rauch beer. And I think he must be very influential on the modern craft beer scene as we know it today, where every second brewer is brewing a Gose, and these beer styles that basically had almost ceased to exist. So we definitely got a lot to thank him for.
Yeah, absolutely. And some of these beer styles would just disappear, and over time they have. They just slowly die out. So people recreating these beer styles, it's great.
Well, it's fun seeing all the new beer styles that are emerging these days, but also there's a lot to draw from through history. And for some reason, I can't really imagine Zeeland brewing a bubblegum chocolate raspberry cold IPA anytime soon.
No, we probably won't be. I guess you never say never, but our influence certainly is from Europe. Are those classic styles rather than the trends, which would come, which tend to come out of from America. Hugely popular, but it's just not where I see us fitting in.
And I think there is a lot to be said for these interesting trends, and I think it's introducing a lot more people into beer, and it's kind of easy to enjoy a beer that tastes like a Mars bar, and which is, there's nothing wrong with that whatsoever. I know some traditional brewers are a bit snooty, but also, as I say, there's a lot to draw from in history, and there's probably a reason why Pilsner has been the king of beers for a couple of centuries now.
So I suppose these, I'm not negative about these modern beer styles. I just wouldn't personally make them a beer that tastes like a Mars bar. For me, I would rather eat a Mars bar and have a beer that tastes like a beer. So Pilsner has been the king of beers for so long. It appeals to a large audience, and our beer styles are that European beer style. So it is about drinkability. It's not about, well, this actually does taste like a Mars bar. It's about those flavors just integrating and enjoying every sip and enjoying the glass. And then when you get to the end of the glass, it's not, oh, I've been there, done that, won't have that again. It's have another one and just, enjoy the session. Enjoy a session on the beer styles.
Well, for anyone that hasn't had Zeeland beers before or isn't really aware of your range, could you quickly run us through your core range and some of the seasonal beers that you like brewing?
Oh, yep, certainly. So our core range, we have three lagers and three ales. So our lagers are Jerry Rig, which is a Heller's. Good Thief is a Pilsner, more in the German Pilsner style. And we have a Bavarian black lager called Black Monk Schwarzbier. Three ales, we have a Pacific Pale Ale Four Strokes, so that's more of a New World Pale Ale. American Pale Ale Long Bomber, and we have Governor, which is an extra special bitter. So that makes up the core range. And then seasonals, we've got, we do Hefeweizen, Dunkelweizen. We've currently got out a Mexican Vienna. We do, what else we got? Oh, Rauch beer, we'll be talking about. We do Saison, Kolsch, got a Brut Pilsner. Last year, we'll bring that out again. We've done Alt beer, Oktoberfest, Märzen.
You're not really going to run out of styles to pillage if you look at the history of European brewing.
Exactly. So much to do.
And you've got a MyBot coming up soon.
Yep. So it's planned for next week. MyBot, I've wanted to do a bock for a little while. Again, there's quite a few different styles of bock. We're going to start off with the MyBot. We'll decoction mash that, which we're going to touch on soon.
What is a MyBot?
A strong lager, basically kind of like a Heller's on steroids, I guess. So it's bigger in the alcohol, bigger body, and bigger everything, bit of bitterness and hop character. But again, we'll be trying to make, say, around 6.5%, maybe a bit more, but again, making it just really approachable, really drinkable, and then just enjoying all those flavors brought together and doing your thing in a glass.
Sounds amazing. Can't wait to drink it.
Mm.
And my buck is one of the linchpin German seasonal styles, isn't it? I think that the people talk about there being five seasons in German beer. And of course, my buck being the one that people drink in May at the start of summer.
Yes. And again, Michael Jackson touches on those things as well, which is always very interesting. Yeah, when the different beers come out, the Maibock has links to Lent and fasting, and well, traditionally monks did a lot of the brewing, probably all the brewing. So they produced a strong beer to get them through Lent. What a great idea.
Sustaining.
Yeah, sustaining and help pass the time.
What do you drink?
I try and drink a range of beers because you don't want to get seller palate. Obviously, we're doing a lot of in-house tasting of our own beers, and we do a lot of in-house tasting of beers over time and how they are surviving in the package. Try and get as many European beers as well, but they travel a long way, so their quality can be a bit so-so. And then, yeah, just various pale ales, IPAs. But yeah, anything interesting that's not too crazy. But anything that sort of broadens your horizon and see what other guys are doing within certain beer styles.
And you're building a bar at the moment.
Yes, we are. So we've been talking about it for a long time and finally got everyone on board, which is the family, and we're well into construction and really looking forward to it. So we're hoping to be open in spring, sometime in spring this year.
Oh, yeah. We haven't really mentioned where you are in the world. So maybe you could paint a picture for our listeners of whereabouts the brewery is in New Zealand.
Absolutely. So we're in a Esk Valley. So that is on the main road from Taupo to Napier. So we're in Hawke's Bay. We're the first vineyard as you come into Hawke's Bay. So it's State Highway 5. So it's just north of Napier. So East Coast, New Zealand. So nice sunny spot of New Zealand. Lots of horticulture, lots of vineyards, apple orchards, stone fruit. So that's where we are.
Well, I remember the first time I drank Zeeland beer, and the first time I met you, which I think was 7 or maybe 8 years ago, and me and my girlfriend were just on holiday in the area, and we're driving by, and I saw a big sign that said beer. So I pulled up to this big barn, but the sign said closed. So I was just turning around, and you were strolling past. So I said, "Hey, could I any chance I could buy some beer off you?" And you opened up, and you sold me some beer, and it was so delicious. And I just remember drinking your beers on the beach. It was summertime, and just I've always had such great memories of my first experience with Zeeland. But then I told you this story a few weeks ago when we brewed together, and you told me that you'd probably just forgotten to put the sign out. I thought you'd open it especially for me.
yeah, I can't remember. It's happened a few times. I've been wandering around the place. Someone pulls in, some backpacker, and then, yeah, it's like, come on in and open up. Yeah, who knows?
It is such a perfect spot for tourists that are traveling in the region. So yeah, I think the bar is going to be, obviously you're building it for the locals and your local community, but just such a great place for people to stop off.
Yeah, we are. So that, yeah, anyone basically coming into Hawke's Bay from the north, like Auckland, Bay of Plenty, Taupo, Waikato. So yeah, they all funnel past through us. So it's a great spot to come in. To drop in when you come into Hawke's Bay. We're quite close to the airport. If you've got a couple of hours to kill before your flight, we've had that in the past. People come out here and try some beers. So we're quite well positioned. We're not in the city, but we're pretty well positioned, I feel.
And pretty convenient for mountain bikers.
Yes, so mountain bike tracks just across the Esk River. So currently they're dropping the logs at the moment in the forest, but they'll be, for the next couple of years, they'll be rebuilding the tracks. So, yeah, a lot of thirsty work going on up in those hills. So we hope to see the mountain bikers come down and visit us too.
Nice. Well, we better talk about Brunhilde's fate.
Yes.
So thank you for collaborating with us at Small Gods on this beer. And yeah, when we thought about the history of smoked beers and who to brew a traditional smoked lager with, it was obvious. It had to be with you. So I'm so glad that you said yes and we got to brew together. And and I'm glad that you decided to do a decoction mash was it the first time you've done one?
Yeah, first time I've done a decoction mash. It's something I've wanted to explore a bit further. So this seemed like a great opportunity to do it. And yeah, thank you guys for coming on board, because a Ralph beer is something that I've wanted to look into, but you're a bit worried about how are people going to react to it. And so having you guys help with the distribution of the beer and the selling of the beer was just gave me a bit more confidence that I'd like, right, let's do this. Let's do it properly. Let's get some nice smoke in there. Let's decoct, mash it.
Well, it's not something people are clamoring out for, is it, really? It's not another thick, hazy IPA.
No.
You wouldn't expect it to fly off the shelves. But it has been well received. I've spoken to so many people. We've had it pouring at the Fridge of Flagon. I've been drinking quite a decent amount of it. And yeah, I think we did a really great job together.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, again, it's that approach that we took in, that we wanted it to be drinkable, but we had to be in a certain different smoke character to it. But we didn't want it to be like a slap in the face smoke. We needed people to enjoy the beer as well. So I think we've ticked all those boxes.
And that style, it just comes from what we were chatting about earlier, where you'd visit a different town or village and the beer would taste radically different. But for the locals, it's just what they've drank for centuries. And of course, in the Bamberg region in northern Bavaria, people drink smoky beers. And there's Schlenkerla, of course, that are the most famous in the region. But in the small city of Bamberg, I think there are 15 breweries or something ridiculous that have been there forever. And the brewers there just decided that when 150 years ago, when new technology came along, people started using smokeless coke to malt their grains. They just decided to carry on doing it the old fashioned way and malting their grains and cooking them over wood. So all of the beers in the area taste a bit smoky.
That's great. That's awesome that they've done that. And yeah, that tradition is carried on. You presented that smoked Helles the night before the brew, and that was great to see how the smokiness can work with a whole range of beers. I would have thought the Helles would be the last beer you'd want to smoke, but it was a very pleasant surprise. That was great to try.
Well, a couple of weeks before the brew day, I did a bit of a tasting session with David Moyner in Auckland, who's a great beer judge and enthusiast that organises events. And he did a lineup of, I think, a dozen different smoked beers. So some various traditional ones like Schlenkerla, and which is Brynhilde's Fate that we made together, definitely falls into that traditional Rauch beer category. But also, it was nice to try various beers at the same time that contain smoke in various degrees and that are just used as one part of the flavor. So one of those was Wigram's do a big stout that's just got a really small amount of smoke to it, and it just balances beautifully just with the chocolate malt. And as you're talking about the Helles from Modern Times, which is I think it's about 4.2%, and if it didn't have the smoke characteristic, it probably would be a bit one-dimensional. It would be a lovely smashable Helles. But just by having that layer of smoke gives it so much more of an interesting complexity. So it's a good ingredient to have in your brewer's toolkit, I think, smoke.
Yeah, absolutely. And once upon a time, every beer would have had an element of smoke in it. So yeah, it's not too foreign really for beer to have that flavour.
And this decoction mash that we keep talking about, so if anyone's listening and doesn't know what the hell that is, that's another technique that came about from, in the olden days, it would have been of necessity that brewers could only partially heat up parts of their wort at one time, right?
So it was a style, the method of mashing for more sort of continental European brewers with the barley that they had on hand. So they had to really work hard on brew day to get everything out of the grain that they needed. So the decoction process, just a matter of pulling some of the grain out, boiling it over a certain amount of time, putting it back into the original mash and raising the temperature that way, and very time consuming and expensive, but that was just how you had to mash in those days. So as science and technologies improved, and malting barley's improved, that method has all but disappeared, really.
I can see why people wouldn't bother these days. It is laborious and it's a hassle, but tasting the beer, obviously we could only tell if we did a direct comparison with a beer that didn't have a decoction mash and the exact same method and recipe at your kit and one that did use it. But maybe it's in my mind, but I feel like the decoction's really added just a complex sweetness to the malt base in the beer.
Yeah, and you see on the brew day the effort that we went into and the what the barley goes through, the boiling, and then the adding back to the main mash, and there has to be some sort of flow-on effect in the beer. And the Brunhilde has that lovely caramel, lovely malt flavour. So yeah, we'd like to think it came from the decoction. And if you read texts and books, there seems to be two trains of thought. There's the authors that just say it's an old method and we don't use it anymore because it's there's no difference in flavour, and we've done tests and there's no difference in flavour in a tasting panel. Then you get the other authors which is Greg Noonan, who talks about the method, goes into great detail and talks about all the advantages of it. And I enjoy reading that sort of author more than the guy that just say, oh, it's not, it's old and expensive and doesn't really do anything to the beer. I like to think that it certainly has a difference.
There's a real danger in following that path of streamlining things and cutting things out and using slightly more efficient processes and using slightly cheaper ingredients because it doesn't affect the flavour. But suddenly after a while you have, you end up with a beer like Boddington's, which is a nothing beer, which I'm sure was a thing of beauty 150 years ago.
Yeah.
So beer created by accountants is not something I want to drink.
Yeah, so now when we do the Maibock with the decoction, it'll be really, really interesting to see on a lighter malt profile what contribution the decoctions make to it.
Yeah, I can't wait to get a cavern up to Auckland. Okay, so to wrap things up, I'm going to ask you the question that I ask everybody on this podcast, which is your desert island beer. You're stranded forever on a desert island, yet magically you have a never-ending supply of a single beer. What are you drinking?
Well, for me, hands down, it would have to be the Belgian Flemish red ale, known as Duchess. Anyone's familiar with that, they'll know what I'm talking about. There's the nice image of the Duchess on it.
Yeah, the Duchess de Burgoyne, I think it is.
This is the one.
Probably.
Yes, thank you. That's the one. It's such a great beer style, such a great beer. Probably not suited to a desert island, but what a magical beer. Just those flavours, balsamic vinegar. They're just so rich and drinkable. It's such a fantastic beer style.
I was actually discussing with Matt, I can't remember if it was on the podcast or just in real life, in the last week, we're talking about what were our first sour beers. And after quite a bit of thought, I've remembered that I probably was sitting in a pub in Loughborough or Nottingham after a session of drinking maybe Duvel or Chimay, all those triples and quads. Mm-hmm. And we just saw this Duchess of Burgoyne on the menu and ordered a round of those. And we were disgusted. It's this beer that tastes like vinegar.
Yeah,
it was just so like puckeringly sour. But yeah, it's like, I think many of the most delicious things, it's an acquired taste. Someone's probably not going to like I think it is an oud brun, isn't it, the style? But someone's probably not going to like that on their first taste.
Yeah, absolutely. It's some people just won't get it. I know my wife, she just doesn't get it, which is fine by me. Every now and again, she'll have a sip. And then, I don't encourage her. So I get the whole bottle myself. It's for me, it's one of those end of the night beers. It's just beautiful.
Well, very, very classy and delicious choice. Well, thanks so much for the chat, Christopher. I'll let you get back to your day in the brewery. And as I say, I'm looking forward to drinking your Maibock sometime soon.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on.
Cheers.